Welcome to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Florida's economy has recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic-induced recession. At least so says a new economic analysis by Moody's Analytics. Seems like good news. But there's some nuance here. The pandemic is still with us. And Tom, of course, hundreds of thousands of jobs around the state have yet to return.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, Melissa. Only about half of the jobs lost in the first 2 months of the pandemic last spring have actually returned to the economy. And tens of thousands of working Floridians have just dropped out of the workforce. They've gone back to school, maybe. Maybe they can't work because they're taking care of children or a family member. Or maybe they've just become frustrated with the kinds of jobs available and have decided to sit it out for the time being.
Now, here's what's new coming up soon. If you're out of work in Florida and collecting unemployment, you will see a pay cut in a couple of weeks. Florida is one of the states ending the $300 a week federal unemployment boost payments, and they're doing it early. Now, this will cut unemployment checks by more than half for many around the state. The maximum state unemployment benefit is $275 a week.
Now, jobs in retail stores, restaurants, bars, hotels, they have been coming back, certainly, in the thousands each month. But many businesses still report having a tough time finding enough people to fill all the shifts. Health concerns and low pay could be keeping people from returning to the job market. So this is where we begin this week on the Florida Roundup. What's the help like at your favorite diner? If you're collecting unemployment, what will the end of the extra federal money mean to you and your job search and your household finances? We want to hear from restaurant workers, from cooks, servers, bartenders, front of the house, back of the house. Did you work at a restaurant before the virus? Have you moved on in your career? And how could this lack of workers affect Florida's economic recovery? 305-995-1800 to join our conversation. 305-995-1800. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at Florida Roundup.
We'll get to your feedback in a moment. So many folks out there are being affected by these changes. But first, let's begin with Hector Sandoval. He's director of the Economic Analysis Program at the state's Bureau of Economic and Business Research. And he's also assistant professor at the University of Florida. Hector, good to have you on the Florida Roundup.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
So tell us, what are the state's current unemployment numbers like, and which groups are being hit the hardest?
Well, as you mentioned, the state lost over 1.2 million jobs due to the pandemic. But currently, the unemployment rate in Florida is 4.8%, and that corresponds to April. The new figure for May is going to be out next Friday. But as you mentioned, we have only recovered about half of the job lost due to the pandemic. Something on the bright side, and it's one of the latest releases, is that the new claims of unemployment benefits, they actually show that we can say that we are back on track with how they used to be before the pandemic. And this is actually a downward trend on weaker claims of unemployment that I have seen over the last months. And this is actually is really describing an improved economic situation. But something that it's important to mention, I think the recovery is far from complete. And I think one of the points that I have see that people miss is, Florida, I mean, this is everybody knows, tourism is one of the largest industries contributing to the Florida economy. But international visitors, they contribute a lot to that economy. And it's still going to be, I mean, we still predict that tourism is going to be one of the main drivers of economic activity in Florida. But the issue is that the U.S. still remains close to most international visitors, including Canadians, right? Mm-hmm. And people from Europe. And according to the figures, just to give you some numbers, there was like in 2019, there were around 3.6 million people from Canada that visit Florida. And there were around 11 million from overseas that came to Florida. And that's something that we are still missing. So I still think that in terms of our economy and our recovery, we still need that that missing piece, which is this tourist forum.
Such an important piece of the puzzle. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay, so a mixed picture then, as you say, we're not out of the woods yet. On the one hand, the numbers are looking up, but then on the other, plenty of people are still struggling. And there is this mismatch we're seeing between businesses desperate to hire workers and workers who either can't find jobs or don't want to go back to the jobs they had before. How do we get through this patch?
Well, I think one of the things is people argue that there is a lot of people not joining the labor market because they have this access to these extra unemployment benefits. But by the end of June, that's going to be there's no longer going to be this extra aid from the federal government. That's going to push some people. I mean, definitely there is some people that are on that situation. But I still think that there is another big part of the people, or something that we don't see, is that there is still a lot of people out of the labor force. I mean, Florida reached more than 10 million people, workers, I think back in 2017. And now based on my countings, we still like more than 350,000 workers that are still out of the labor force. It's kind of like these people, maybe some of them have like health issues related to COVID, or they are waiting to have a childcare or waiting for schools to open. And that may be retaining them. And that might also explain some of these frictions that we're seeing.
We're getting calls about that, Hector. CJ in Tampa is out of work. CJ, you still need that federal unemployment check?
Yeah, I work in the performing arts industry, and we were hit very hard by the pandemic, and the numbers still don't allow us to get back to full business. We're optimistic that in the coming months we will, but for the time being, we still have a lot of people with highly specialized skill sets that are out of work because we can't get back yet. And so I do think it's premature for the state to end the additional federal benefits there.
Thank you, CJ. Dave in Lakeland is in the same boat. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm just like CJ. I'm in the entertainment business. I'm a lifelong musician, and my gigs haven't come back. I think I do have one in October, but I was looking forward to the help through September. Basically, the 10 weeks that have been taken away for myself and everyone else, that's a loss of $3,000. In my case, that's 2 months' rent. I do want to point out that on all the local news stations and even the beginning of your show, they mentioned that the unemployment in Florida is 275. And maybe some people in the public politically don't think that's such a big deal. Oh, 275. Well, they're still getting 275. Well, really, everyone needs to start saying that, wait a minute, these people that are gig workers, they're not getting 275 a week when the 300 goes away. They're getting 125. 125.
So, yeah. Thank you, Dave. If I could put that to Hector Sandoval. Hector, critics of the move to end these federal unemployment checks early are calling it a political decision, not an economic one. And they say it will cause real harm to thousands across the state. What say you?
I think it's true, because we don't really know. I agree that there is definitely some fraction of people who are not joining the labor force because they are going back to work because of these unemployment benefits. But we don't really know what is the share of all these unemployed people. Maybe it's just a tiny fraction, which means like really all the rest of the people that are there, they still really need these benefits. And that's something that I will say, like, I really think that they don't really, that these people that are just not taking the jobs, because it's really a small fraction. It's really a small fraction. And there is people like the people here that are telling that they really need the benefit. So I really think that's something, one of the things that is going on.
Lots of tweets about this as well. Here's one. I still return to eat at the restaurant where I used to wait tables, but lack of pay, tips, and a decent wage prevents many to coming back to the serviced industry for jobs. And Tom tweets, too, asking us to mention that part of the labor shortage involves undocumented workers in the state as well.
There's a lot of people behind all those statistics that Hector has talked about. Stick with us, Hector. Lauren Titus is going to join our conversation now, editor of Edible Northeast Florida. Lauren, what's demand been like for restaurant workers?
The demand has been excessive. It was a challenging workforce market before the pandemic, and the pandemic has really shed a light on some of the challenges in the hospitality industry overall, between the lack of qualified workers to some of the working conditions that that employees have to live in normal times. And during the pandemic, that was certainly a critical issue for pretty much everybody who worked in a restaurant or in the hospitality industry overall.
And so talk to us a little bit more about those pre-COVID challenges and how the pandemic has really accelerated some of those and amplified some of those, particularly around working conditions, now working with a pandemic, and the wage question.
Well, in the restaurant and bar industry, if you weren't really happy with where you were working, you could probably go down the street and get another job pretty easily. So there's always been that fluidity during normal times. However, during the pandemic, as restaurants closed, a lot of workers had to find some other means of employment, of an income. And we're finding that there are many people who have left the hospitality industry altogether. Another critical issue for many workers has been childcare, as has been pointed out. And with much of the childcare management done by women, we're finding that women have been hardest hit by the labor shortage during the pandemic. If the daycare isn't open or if school is virtual, you can't go back to that restaurant or bar and work if you don't have that support for your children.
And what about the wage question? Hospitality is known for low wages, certainly entry-level workers, and we're seeing more and more larger companies particularly raising wages. Universal Orlando, Chipotle, both announcing they're raising starting pay to $15 an hour. Are smaller restaurants, smaller businesses that make up the bulk of hospitality following suit?
Well, they're finding that they have to. Primarily a below minimum wage plus tips industry, restaurants are finding that they have to get to that $15 an hour rate just for people to come in for an interview, which is challenging for restaurants, small businesses, because the margins are so thin to begin with, and to have to pay more for your workers. And on top of that, the increase in cost of food and other supplies, it's highlighting even more the challenges in the hospitality industry that we as diners take for granted. We're not, we're always shocked when we see the true cost of food, because our food system has been supported over the years to provide low prices, so that when we see some of the true cost reflected in the price of when we're dining out, people start to complain and wonder why that's the case.
Yeah. Lauren, stick with us. We're talking about the restaurant industry, hospitality jobs in Florida here. About half the jobs that were lost in 2 months during the first 2 months of the pandemic have returned to the Florida economy. Tens of thousands of people have dropped out of the labor market. 305-995-1800 to share your story. Roger is in Pinellas Park. Roger, thanks for calling. What's your story?
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking the call. Just a couple observations. First of all, I feel for the hospitality and entertainment industry. When you get back out there, please tip generously. I've been fortunate enough to remain employed throughout, mostly working from home since 6 months ago, 7 months ago, maybe 1 or 2 days a week into the office. And I just don't know anyone that would sit at home when they can work, be it working at $600 versus a $700 benefit. I don't know those people. Maybe y'all knew a different class of people than I did.
Yeah, I hear you, Roger. Thanks for sharing that thought. Sally, you're up next. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Sally. Sally, you're on the radio.
Oh, okay. So repeat what I said to you?
Well, it's the first time you and I talked. You spoke with our phone screener, okay. And I appreciate you telling your story. Okay, but now tell all of Florida your story.
My story is that I have worked on and off in the service industry, restaurant, catering, and I am also in show business. And I have lots of friends who make six figures and happily took the unemployment when they were told to stay home. Travel agents, teachers, monitors, secretaries. And I just feel like it's really unfair to pull that unemployment from, you know, the entertainment industry and people that work so hard in the service industry. And they're just getting a bad rap about, oh, they're all just staying home because they want the money. That is not true. There may be some, but that is not the big picture. Everybody wants to get back to work and be paid fairly. And I think they're just hitting all the people who are lower income and just pointing out that they're just sitting home and filing their toenails and collecting money. And I just don't agree with that.
Sally, it's an important point. And Hector Sandoval, the economic research has been looked at this for a good long time. And there's little evidence that there are millions of people who are purposely sitting out of the labor market because of unemployment benefits. But I want to ask you about the economic impact of in the Florida economy on spending of consumers who had been collecting the additional federal unemployment check of $300 a week and no longer have that money coming in. Can there be a ripple effect in consumer spending?
Yeah, definitely. That's actually one of the things to actually think is like people that receive the unemployment benefits, they will use most of the money, or they will not save this money. So all the money will go to spending. And so that's really good. That's actually going to benefit all the local economy are just getting these ripple effects. And it's true, as long as once these people start to receiving less money, the economy will feel that impact.
Yeah, and we mentioned this earlier in a caller, and we have a tweet about this $275 maximum state unemployment figure. Laura sends us a note on Twitter saying that everyone cites that maximum number, but many people on unemployment in Florida get the minimum $125 a week from the state. Share your conversation. Share your thoughts with us, 305-995-1800. Lauren Titus with Edible Northeast Florida. How could ending the federal unemployment booster impact the supply of hospitality workers? What are restaurant owners hoping for?
Well, there are definitely some people who will probably go back to work, but I did want to point out, and this maybe alludes to the caller, her comment, just because people are ready to get back out there and want to go out to eat doesn't mean that the virus is gone. There are still a lot of hospitality workers who are concerned about their health and safety in restaurants and bars, and they're not really willing to put their lives at risk to go out to get back to work. Line cooks were one of the most dangerous jobs to have during the height of COVID last year. So, you know, we really need to take all of these different factors.
Yes, I think that's so important. As we're hearing from all of the Floridians out there, everybody's got a unique story. Share yours with us. 305-995-1800. Call us. We'll be right back here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about the Florida economy here as we are 15 months into the pandemic. Only about half of the jobs lost during the pandemic have been restarted here in the Sunshine State. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Hector Sandoval is still with us, Director of Economic Analysis Program for the Bureau of Economic and Business Research, also an assistant professor at UF. Lauren Titus is editor of Edible Northeast Florida. We want to hear your story about working or trying to find work in this pandemic economy. Laura in Orlando is going to be joining us here now. There you are. Hello, Laura. Thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to weigh in on the talk about working in the restaurant industry. I've worked in a variety of restaurants for the last 6 or 7 years, helping put myself through school. And when I just wanted to point out that the customers are also feeling the pressures, the monetary pressures of the pandemic from their employment, from their childcare costs, from the rising food prices that they're seeing. And when they feel that, when they go out to eat, they tip less or they don't tip. Just in general, we're seeing like such a decrease in tip amount. And when you rely on that as, frankly, in many cases, the majority of your salary, it's really just not worth it to go back to that industry.
Yeah. Laura, I appreciate that sharing that story there, Melissa, right? I mean, if you've gone out to eat, at the bottom of that receipt, sometimes it's the 18, 20, 22% that's stipulated for the suggested gratuity. And after what hospitality and restaurant workers have gone through in the last 15 months, certainly you've got to look with a little bit more generosity, I would hope, as a consumer, as a diner.
Absolutely.
For some of these folks and what they have to deal with.
Tip generously, please, if you can do so. 305-995-1800. Lots of calls from across the state. Michael in Daytona Beach. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to say, well, thank you. I wanted to say that to expect people to go back to work for what are essentially sub-minimum wage jobs while trying to feed themselves and their children and trying to pay mortgages or rent is outrageous. If minimum wage had kept up with productivity and inflation since 1970, the minimum wage would be $26 an hour, not $15. And to expect people to work for nothing amounts to slavery.
Michael, thanks for bringing up the issue of the minimum wage. You know, Lauren Titus, we are going to do in a staggered fashion. We are going to raise the minimum wage in Florida. It's not going to be phased in overnight, but people will start making more per hour. Of course, the arguments against that, particularly on the smart of many small business owners, is that they cannot afford to pay workers more. But I think what we're living through economically right now shows that something's got to give. That if we want to go out to eat at restaurants and bars, that if we want people to serve us, we have to pay them more. That's just the bottom line.
Yeah, exactly. Especially, I'm hearing that from a lot of hospitality workers that while customers are eager to get back to dine, they're not the most friendly customers that they've experienced pre-COVID. You know, the mask situation angered a lot of customers. And when employees were trying to just, you know, remind them of the policies, a lot of customers were getting angry and taking it out on the wait staff on the front of the house. So a lot of employees don't really want to have to deal with that. What I'm hearing also from some restaurateurs is because of the labor shortage and the increase in costs of both labor and ingredients, they're actually cutting out either days of the week or a full shift altogether, like they're not serving lunch, for instance, Monday through Friday, as a way to both save cost and to deal with the lack of labor.
It's an interesting forced market reaction because of the lack of the labor supply. Hector Sandoval, the Director of Economic Analysis and Program for the Bureau of Economic and Business Research. Let me ask you, I have a teenage son who is looking for a retail job. He was looking at a small retailer, one of his favorite stores. They were hiring. They were requiring 3 years of retail experience. To me, that struck me as excessive, given the labor shortage that is in the marketplace and the likely wage of that position. What does that strike you? What does that tell you?
I agree with you. This is kind of weird to conceive, given what we're here seeing in the labor market. Just making these requirements are really excessive for these kind of positions. Something that I would like to say is, I mean, there is a Florida approved the increase of the minimum wage, and that's going to gradually phase in. Mm-hmm. But because of these changes in the minimum wage, I think we're still going to see some readjustments in the labor market. We're still going to see some mm-hmm. small business suffering, closing, and some other improving. And so we're still going to see a lot of friction in terms because of this issue.
Lots of tweets. Here's one. The Florida unemployment system was designed to fail. So many workers in positions with no benefits and low wages were literally thrown to the streets. Now these people might be reconsidering their options. Yeah, I mean, of course, we have been covering for some time now how difficult it was for many in the state to access any benefits at all when the pandemic began. That's still an issue. Lots of calls here on the Florida Roundup. Jordan in Brooksville. Hi, Jordan. How are you? Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great on this Friday. What's your story?
Okay, so basically, first and foremost, I've worked in a lot of different cook's jobs. So, like, I've been a line cook for probably, I would say, the past 6 or 7 years. I kind of got out of it for a little bit during the pandemic. I was working at a big box retailer, and I kind of felt unsafe because, especially during the beginning of the pandemic, we had a lot of people come in not wearing masks. They weren't social distancing. So, like, take it as a grain of salt. Some people believed in it. Some people didn't. Eventually left that job. Kind of ran out of savings almost. So mm-hmm. I had to get another job. I got a job at $15 an hour. And even right now, we're still having a hard time finding people to come back to work. And you have to look at it this way, too. A lot of big box retailers and a lot of, like, big chain restaurants, they don't give part-time employees benefits at all. And on top of that, a lot of them were only paying people maybe $10 to $12 an hour, and you're getting part-time. So, you know, if you're only getting 25 to 30 hours a week, how much are you really taking home each week? And then you have to pay for your own benefits. And so, like, I feel that a lot of people during the pandemic saw that as an opportunity to, like, kind of stay out of the spotlight of not catching COVID and bringing it home to their families, but also being able to kind of, like, relieve themselves of not having to have health insurance just in case something
sure.
bad happened
sure.
to them.
Sure. Jordan, yeah. thank you so much for sharing your insights. It's really been so illuminating to hear, Tom, from these folks across the state who are living this reality every day.
Yep. Definitely putting voices to the statistics on the economy in Florida. Hector Sandoval, Director of Economic Analysis for the Bureau of Economic and Business Research and also at UF. Thank you for your time, Hector. And Lauren Titus, Editor of Edible Northeast Florida. Lauren, thanks for sharing your perspective as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thanks to you both. Well, call it Florida's Bridgegate. This week, Florida received negative national attention during Pride Month, and it all involved lighting up some state bridges in rainbow colors to mark the occasion and support LGBTQ equality.
The downtown Acosta Bridge in Jacksonville was lit up in rainbow lights, but then the state's Department of Transportation ordered the lights to be taken down, saying they were out of compliance. And this caused a big pushback because other lighting schemes on the same bridge have been allowed to stay up in the weeks past. Officials in two other Florida counties asked for permission to light up their bridges in Pride Month, but they were told no. And by the way, Pride lights are back on in Jacksonville after this flap went viral.
Right. And there's actually going to be a Pride March Saturday across the Acosta Bridge. Hagen Brody is mayor of the city of Sarasota. His city was denied permission to light a bridge there for Pride Month. Mayor Brody, thanks for joining us. Hi, Mayor. If you can hear me, go ahead and let us know if you can hear us.
Hey, I can hear you. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So tell us what happened when you tried to light up a bridge in your neck of the woods in the rainbow colors.
So in the city of Sarasota, we have a large, beautiful bridge called the Ringling Causeway. And I have been active with our Florida Department of Transportation down here, coordinating other bridge lighting schemes over the years. I was elected in 2017. And so not really thinking much else of it, I requested the bridge be lit rainbow pride colors for the upcoming June Pride Month. This was back in May, and was denied based on some new criteria apparently promulgated by Florida Department of Transportation.
Right, and apparently we're a little tight on time. What's your reaction to the governor's office saying that their administration had nothing to do with shutting down these rainbow color requests?
Well, I mean, I have no reason to disbelieve that. However, if the governor's office does know of it, he's more than welcome to get involved and, you know, help work out a solution as we approach the nightclub shooting in Orlando.
Sure.
You know, I think it's an important gesture that we can make.
And Mayor Brody, since Jacksonville caused a stink when their bridge colors were shut down and they've been allowed to go back up, will you then go back to the state and say, can I light my bridge since Jacksonville got to rainbow up its bridge?
And that's exactly what I did. As we approach the Pulse anniversary, I emailed our Florida Department of Transportation Secretary, kind of showing him some new information with what was happening up in Jacksonville at their FDOT, apparently looked more amenable to lighting the bridge up for Pride. And so I sent him that request 2 days ago, and apparently they are discussing it. So that's encouraging. I'm optimistic. I hope that we'll be able to get the Ringling Bridge lit up for the end of Pride Month, but especially for the Pulse nightclub shooting memorials that we have throughout, happening throughout the city.
And we'll follow that progress. Hagan Brody, mayor of the city of Sarasota, thank you so much. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
The backlash over rainbow lights on bridges came as that somber anniversary approaches. Saturday is the day. It marks 5 years since a gunman killed 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Abe Avaraya is the healthcare reporter at our member station, WMFE, in Orlando. Abe, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Governor Ron DeSantis has been receiving criticism over the past week or so for using his budget line item veto power to cross out funding that was aimed for mental health services for Pulse survivors. Tell us about what the funding was geared toward.
That definitely sparked a lot of controversy, especially with some of the people who survived the shooting. And it came as we're coming up on, the 5 year mark and with the beginning of Pride Month. So it really didn't sit well with a lot of the people. It's important to kind of point out, too, that this wasn't just money from the state. The federal funding has dried out for a lot of the mental health services. And so the city and the county were kind of cobbling together money to get this going. And they really were counting on that $150,000 from the state to really be able to continue offering these services. And so there's a lot of questions about what's going to happen now and going forward.
The spokesperson for the governor mentioned that the overall budget for community mental health in the state increased by over $200 million. Will that go to help the LGBTQ plus center in Orlando that lost this specific line item for $150,000?
I don't know the answer to that off the bat, but what I can tell you though is that, the types of services that you're looking at for victims of a violent terrorist attack, substance abuse with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's the LGBT plus community, and it's, there's a lot of different intersections there about how you best treat patients with that combination of things. So this is a very specific niche that you're looking at of trying to deliver the services that these people need. And the whole reasoning for going after state money for this is that it wasn't just the 53 people who were shot in the club. It wasn't just the several hundred people who fled. It impacted broader than that. And to have, money coming into this to try and keep people to be able to function as members of society and be contributing members to an economy, frankly, is how this money was sort of framed to legislators. And this is why you want to go ahead and put money towards this.
You've done a lot of journalism around the first responders to this mass shooting, to this terrorist attack. 5 years on, what can you share with us?
Probably the most important thing is there have been some legislative changes around how the workers' compensation system in Florida handles post-traumatic stress disorder in first responders. That is a recognized issue now. There has been a move where more and more of the police pension funds and fire department pensions that sort of handle whether or not someone can get, you know, if you throw your back out as a firefighter or you are shot as a police officer and get critically wounded, you can't do your job anymore. You know, you're able to get a disability pension. And a lot of these pension boards over the last 5 years 30? Have reevaluated what is the criteria. There's much more open and honest discussion about the impacts that, you know, not just a horrific tragedy like the Pulse nightclub shooting has, but also the day-to-day stressors 15? That build over a career for a lot of these first responders.
Abe Abaraya is the healthcare reporter at our member station in Orlando, WMFE. Abe, thanks for your time and sharing your reporting with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Still to come, we speak with Equality Florida, plus your calls and tweets about Pride Month and the Pulse anniversary. That's next here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio, 305-995-1800 to give us a call or tweet the show at Florida Roundup. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting us. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. 305-995-1800 to call us up. Tweet us at Florida Roundup as we talk about Pride Month, the five-year anniversary of the tragedy in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, and the flap overlighting Florida bridges in rainbow colors. Joe Saunders is Senior Political Director for Equality Florida, and he's on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Melissa, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to have you on. So your organization, Equality Florida, has said this week that there are few coincidences when it comes to the actions of the DeSantis administration. Is that another way of saying that you believe that the governor or people acting on his behalf were deliberately muzzling a show of support for Pride Month on the bridges?
You know, I think it goes much deeper than that, Melissa. And I do want to thank you and Tom for having me back on the show and for elevating these issues and, of course, elevating the stories of people lost at Pulse. This is such an important time to have this conversation. And it's hard to watch the actions of this governor over the last 2 weeks and not see intentionality and not see politics. So here are the things that we know. We know that on the first day of Pride, of this month, just a few weeks before the five-year remembrance of the tragedy of Pulse nightclub, he signed the first piece of anti-LGBT law to pass in a quarter of a century in Florida. He banned transgender young people from playing sports, kicked middle schoolers off of their soccer teams. On the second day of Pride in June, he vetoed funding that was meant to go directly to survivors of the Pulse nightclub tragedy and their families. And he vetoed funding that would help LGBT homeless youth get access to housing. And then in the second week of Pride, the news breaks that he has been silencing Pride in public facilities and in public bridges, first by, you know, his administration denying even lighting them. And then, of course, in your neck of the woods, Melissa, in Jacksonville, actually requiring that they be pulled. When we know that even celebrating football games has been approved on the Acosta Bridge in Jacksonville, that it's hard to see that as anything other than a direct attack that plays to a really specific base of people who just don't believe that LGBTQ people exist in the state.
Well, certainly the rainbow lights are just one manifestation of all of the different things you're talking about. The movement for equality is in part about visibility. That's what the lights are for, to make a group of people who've traditionally been marginalized, discriminated against, visible. And so I think that's why this has caused so much upset. Now, this week, Congress approved a bill making the Pulse nightclub the National Pulse Memorial. It will make it a national memorial, even though it wouldn't be part of the national park system, wouldn't get federal funding. What are your thoughts about this move in Washington and what this means for the equality movement overall?
I think it's such an important moment to mark that a unanimous bipartisan group of lawmakers in both the Senate and the House have taken this important step. And I'm spending a lot of time right now, Melissa, talking as we move through the conversation as a community about Pulse, talking about what 5 years has marked. I think that we can't deny that in the last 5 years, in at least in part, because of the public response, the community's response to the tragedy, we've seen progress. We've seen progress on gun violence in this state. We've seen progress on LGBT rights in this state. I think that the memorial is a sign of that progress as well. But I also think we have to say out loud that there is a very real backlash to that progress that we are living in today. And Florida's ground zero. You know, this is one of the worst years on record for anti-LGBT laws being introduced and passed around the country. The Human Rights Campaign, who we work closely with, has marked that in a number of ways. More anti-LGBT laws have passed and introduced and passed around the country than the last 3 years of state legislative sessions combined. And so while we can mark the importance of that progress, we also have to brace for that backlash. And I think that's what's happening in Florida right now today. I think that's what's coming from the governor's office. And I think we have just so much more work to do.
Joe, it's Tom. You mentioned some of the progress that you have seen since that horrific early morning at the Pulse nightclub. When it comes to firearms and guns, however, the legislature really didn't act after Pulse. It was the Parkland school tragedy that thrust that topic into the hands of the legislature, and which acted after. So I'm wondering, as you kind of contextualize that, as you think about that, help us kind of understand how the LGBT community is viewing the differences or the progress when it comes to not only LGBTQ rights and standing, but also particularly when it comes to the very real issue of firearms and guns.
It's a great question. That's a great question. And, you know, as a former state lawmaker, mm-hmm. I represented part of East Orlando in the Florida House. I am very familiar with the inertia and the inaction of this legislature. I think it's really important for people to know and to understand that, you know, some of the loudest voices coming out of Parkland in the aftermath of that horrific tragedy were members of the school's Gay and Straight Alliance. That for those of us who are in the gun violence reform, gun safety reform space, that the linkages in these movements, the response to Pulse and the response to Parkland, two horrific tragedies that grabbed the global microphone, are intricately linked and that they built upon each other. So I think the legacy of the reforms that came out of Parkland are very much part of the legacy for Pulse. What we know is that in the legislation, Tom, that passed, you referenced this, that there were important reforms that were made. Florida shifted the minimum age to buy a gun from 18 to 21. We created really important red flag laws that allow a court to intervene and take someone's gun if they are a threat to themselves or to someone else. Those are signs of a step forward. We also put guns in the hands of teachers, which at Equality Florida, and I personally, you know, believe is a step back. So that seems to be the theme of this work. Whether you're looking at LGBTQ non-discrimination protections, whether you're looking at the important work of protecting people from weapons of war, we make progress in these moments, but there are forces who would pull us backwards. And I think that's what June 12th becomes about, a reminder that we've got to honor with action by always being vigilant, always being ready to fight for the people that we lost on June 12th.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Our guest right now is Joe Saunders, Senior Political Director for Equality Florida. Barbara is on the line from Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, I just wanted to say I was listening earlier and somebody said, I think it was you, that the governor's office said that it wasn't their office that said no to the lights. And I think that's just really disingenuous, given that the Department of Transportation is a department under the governor and the executive branch. So he easily has control of that. It's not like he can't do anything about it. So it's just one more time the governor dodging his responsibility. That's it.
Barbara, thanks. Joe Saunders, a spokesperson for the governor, said they had nothing to do with the decisions regarding the bridges. But as you pointed out, it's just been the latest in a long line of slights to this community.
You know, it's really clear to me. I appreciate this question or this point so much. I think disingenuous is a really on the nose word for the moment that we're living in. It's obvious to anyone who's paying attention that this governor has decided that he's running for president or is really interested in the 20% of Floridians who would be important for a run for president. And those are the same 20% of Floridians who don't believe that transgender Floridians exist, Melissa. You know, like these are the same folks who would see marriage equality erased, that they would see a sodomy laws brought back. That's just really clear. And so what we see over and over again from this governor is the fanning flames of culture wars. So I don't buy that at all. This governor has set up a culture within his administration that pivots and capitulates to a really specific segment of this community. We know that FDOT, the Florida Department of Transportation, got complaints about the bridges and that they capitulated to those complaints, ignoring what this would mean, feel, and
actually,
see
you know, it was
LGBTQ Floridians in Jacksonville.
They say it was only a handful of calls in Jacksonville. Few calls. Yeah.
Five.
Yeah.
Five, I think it was.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
Joe, I want to ask you, the governor is a focus of a lot of this criticism, but it's the legislature that's also acted in the case of the prohibition of transgender student athletes, for instance. It's the legislature, House members and Senate members that are popularly elected from local jurisdictions. You were one of those for a good number of years out of the Orlando area. So it's not solely the governor. However, he arguably, I imagine, has set the tone. So my question, I suppose, is more about the broader support or whether or not it reflects broader support than just the particular political ambitions of one Ron DeSantis.
Sure. Right. And I think that's why conversations around culture are so important right now. The culture that's being set, that's being promulgated by those who hold power in the state of Florida. You know, they're one of the most disappointing things about the legislative action around the transgender youth sports ban was how folks who should have known better, folks who have in the past signaled that they don't follow the whims of the most conservative voters in this state, that they actually understand that millions of LGBTQ Floridians live in Florida and that their voices matter too, that all of those Republican members who live in power, folks like education chair Chris Letvala, we just got a caller from Fort Lauderdale, like Representative Chip Lamarca.
I've got to interrupt you, folks. And I apologize, but we're short on time, but we do appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
Joe Saunders, Senior Political Director for Equality Florida.
And thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, along with thanking our producers, Heather Schatz and Andrea Podermo.
WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones, and our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday. Have a great weekend.